NBA, the Bucks lose to the Celtics, 112-107. The Bulls had the night off. Tonight, the Bucks are off, and the Bulls play in Atlanta. In the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to Nashville 3-1. They're off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, February 26th. Pretty decent day all in all. Partly sunny, breezy, and seasonal. Today's high 39. Tonight's overnight low 29. Pretty good weekend coming our way. Listen to this. Saturday, sunny, windy, and mild. A high of 53. Sunday, 40% chance of rain. A high of 55. This morning, the sun is shining. Wind is from the northwest at 5. It's a little chilly. 25 degrees Racine and Kenosha. 20 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. A little bit of a wind chill at 20 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance your career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is always available online at carthage.edu/grad.
We are turning back the clock to 1976, which, of course, was the year of America's bicentennial. And it happened to be, in some respects, a really interesting, in some ways kind of tumultuous time in our country's history. We were emerging from the nightmare of Vietnam and Watergate and so on, but America had plenty of turbulence still remaining, and a lot of change was in the air. And, of course, also the excitement of our country's 200th birthday. And mixed into all of that was also a particularly eventful and intriguing season of Major League Baseball. And that is the primary focus of a wonderful new book called Stars and Strikes, Baseball and America in the Bicentennial Summer of 1976. The author of the book is an award-winning writer, Dan Epstein, who has written extensively for Rolling Stone, Fox Sports, Los Angeles Times, and many, many other publications as well. He makes his home right down the road from us in Chicago, and I'm very, very excited to speak with him about this book, which is published by St. Martin's Thomas Dunn Books. Again, Stars and Strikes, Baseball and America in the Bicentennial Summer of 76. Dan Epstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here.
I am so glad you wrote this book. It's just fascinating. And
thank you.
I happen to be of an age where I was 16 years old in 1976, so although not a particularly avid baseball fan, especially then, more so now, a lot of what you talk about, I remember vividly, but a lot of it I hadn't really thought about in the longest time. And I wonder if you could just begin first by talking about your choice to write about this year in baseball history, because in many respects, as you say, it is a year that was quite significant, yet, in your words, woefully underappreciated by baseball historians.
Absolutely. Well, I guess the root of this project was 6 years ago I published a book on baseball in the 70s as a whole. It was called Big Hair and Plastic Grass, and it's where I went through the entire decade of, you know, just kind of cataloging and chronicling all the changes, all the storylines that went through baseball in the 1970s. And I found that the most difficult chapter to complete was the 1976 chapter, because there was so much interesting stuff that went on that sort of went on a slightly lower level than, you know, who were involved in the pennant races, which players won the batting championships, that sort of thing. There was so much to do with the players' labor movements, with Marvin Miller and the, you know, the reserve clause being not completely struck down, but sort of watered down enough to allow for full-scale free agency, which drastically changed the economics of baseball as we know it. There were so many interesting characters involved, whether it was George Steinbrenner kind of coming back from his two-year suspension for illegal donations to the Nixon campaign to take the reins of the Yankees again, to Bill Veeck buying the White Sox for the second time and injecting all kinds of wacky promotions into White Sox culture at Comiskey Park, Ted Turner buying the Braves and doing something similar in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, and of course the rise of the sudden rise of Mark the Bird Fidrich, who was this rookie pitcher for the Tigers who came out of nowhere and then, you know, made his first start in the month of May, and then within about 6 weeks became this, you know, wasn't just a baseball hero, but was just became this kind of pop cultural icon.
If I may ask, how old were you in 1976? Judging at least from the photograph that's on the back of the book, you appear to be younger than I am.
I am. not by a whole lot. I was 10 in 1976, and that was the year that I really fell in love with baseball for the first time, and, you know, in part because that was the spring that the Bad News Bears came out in theaters, and I went with some friends to catch a screening of that, and that just, you know, I mean, talk about a movie that changes your life. I mean, that really made me want to play baseball, because the kids on the screen looked and sounded and swore like my friends and I did. So it was just like, wow, that's us, and I could play baseball and have fun like that. And so from there, I just kind of, you know, started playing, started just absorbing all I could about the sport. But like you say, you know, when you're in it, when you're in the year, you're not really thinking necessarily about all the different forces and storylines that are occurring. So I just sort of lived 1976, and I loved it. I loved the bicentennial celebrations. I loved the music, the movies, CB radio, Pong, you know, all the fads of the time. But looking back, it was really, in writing this book and researching it, was really interesting for me, because I was kind of coming back to it with still that sense of childlike wonder, but now I had the capacity to really understand why 1976 was like it was.
And one of the things I tried to summarize, I don't know how good a job I did, was to summarize kind of the strange mix of our country's collective mood, in that there were certain real nightmares that we had, at least for the most part, left behind us by 1976. But there was also still a lot in the air to be, in a sense, kind of discouraged about or worried about.
Right.
So it is
not like it
was this era of good feeling altogether.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I think in one sense it was. Like, hey, let's you know, we've been out of Vietnam for a year. Nixon's out of the White House. Let's step back, take a, take a deep breath and remember, you know, what we love about America, and that this 200-year experiment actually produced some things we can really be proud of. I like to say this was a very small period in American history where we were embracing our inner Ben Franklin as opposed to our inner John Wayne. But at the same time, there was, you know, there was a lot of, you know, it wasn't like everything was cool. You know, there was still, you know, a lot of people felt really disenfranchised by the bicentennial celebrations. You know, basically anybody who wasn't white felt like, well, this is great, but this isn't really our celebration. There was a very hard-fought presidential campaign going on that, you know, eventually it ended up with Jimmy Carter in the White House. But, you know, we saw the Republican Party kind of going at it, where this was kind of Ronald Reagan's dry run for the White House, and the incumbent was Gerald Ford, who actually had, you know, he had replaced Spiro Agnew when Agnew resigned, and then replaced Richard Nixon when Nixon resigned in 1974. There was a lot of economic uncertainty. New York was, you know, just coming off the whole Ford to New York drop dead scenario, where you know, the city was going into default. You know, this America's number one city in terms of population and economic power is, you know, looks like it's going to just collapse into the Hudson River, and there's a lot of feeling like, well, you know, go ahead because it's a cespool. There's anti-busing riots in Boston. There are you know, all kinds of issues in Detroit, where the auto industry is starting to really feel the pinch of the Japanese automakers. But and then, you know, just on an urban level, there's a, you know, a huge amount of raise in crime rates. Well, the, you know, that they're laying off cops. I mean, it's definitely it's a year of struggle for a lot of people.
I would love to just talk for a moment about the bicentennial celebration, because you spend a little time talking about it in chapter 8 of your book called Afternoon Delight. And it's really, really interesting. I mean, it sort of whetted my appetite to go searching for some other book that might explore it in even more detail, although I'm not sure there is a book out there. But I'm sure glad you talk about as much of it as you did. There are two things I wanted to ask you about, to just kind of mention to our listeners. These are just two of many interesting things you talk about. One was the real threat that the city of Philadelphia might be, in a sense, overrun by tens of thousands of protesters in what should have been its finest hour. And the other thing I want you to tell the listeners about is the disaster that happened in Baltimore. I mean, disaster with a small D, but I mean, nevertheless, some plans that went rather catastrophically wrong with their bicentennial celebration. It's the kind of thing that I think most of us maybe knew very little about at the time, and certainly now it's sort of lost to history. But thanks to your book, now we have this really intriguing information.
Let's start with the Baltimore thing. I mean, that is something that I had no idea happened until I started researching the book. Basically, the city of Baltimore decided that one of the things that they were going to do for July 4th, you know, which is sort of the culmination of the bicentennial celebrations, was build the world's biggest birthday cake, because, you know, happy birthday, America. And they poured, at the moment I forget exactly how much it cost the city, but it cost them a lot of money. And they had it like on a barge out in the harbor. And supposedly, I guess the plan was they were going to make the money back that they'd spent on the cake by selling off pieces to people, you know, sort of like commemorative piece of the world's biggest birthday cake. And a few nights before the bicentennial, a few nights before July 4th, there was a huge rainstorm which washed all the frosting off it. So they had to refrost it, and then it was overrun by rats. So they never really recouped the expenses that they spent on the world's biggest birthday cake. But you know, nice try, Baltimore. Mm-hmm. In the case of Philadelphia, I mean, Philadelphia. If you go back, and I talk about this in the book, you go back a few years, really for about close to 10 years before the bicentennial. Boston and Philadelphia had been sort of jockeying to be the official city of the bicentennial. They knew this was going to be a big deal. Like, let's, you know, and both cities obviously had a big claim to, you know, being the city of the bicentennial because of their role in the American Revolution. But basically, the committee that was choosing this wisely decided, why don't we let every town in America have their own bicentennial celebrations, and you know, we can sort of diffuse this rivalry here. But Philadelphia, obviously having so many places of historical interest relating to the American Revolution, were gearing up for a huge celebration. They moved the Liberty Bell at the beginning of the year to its new home, to kind of a newer area which would accommodate a much greater amount of visitors, and they were all set for a huge July 4th, you know, influx of tourism. But what happened was a number of radical left-wing groups, as I mentioned earlier, you know, folks who felt disenfranchised by the whole celebrations, decided that they were going to come to Philadelphia and protest. And protest that, you know, the city had a long history of racially tinged policies, and so they're going to protest that. So that was off-putting to a lot of potential tourists, as was there were rumors that, you know, all the hotel rooms were going to be sold out, that, you know, there was no place to park, that there was no place to go to the bathroom. So what happened was, I mean, the city of Philadelphia still drew a lot of people for the July 4th weekend, but it was nowhere near what they were expecting, because I think a lot of people just thought, you know what, I don't want to deal with protests. I don't want to worry about where I'm going to be able to go to the bathroom. I don't want to, you know, get there and find that our room has been sold out from under us. Let's just stay home and enjoy our town's fireworks and cakewalk and whatever.
We're speaking with Dan Epstein. We're talking about his book, Stars and Strikes, Baseball in America in the Bicentennial Summer of 76. And we should make clear that your book actually doesn't just talk about the bicentennial, but about all kinds of other important events and sort of cultural landmarks and popular songs, popular movies, all kinds of things that really help us sort of re-experience 1976 for those of us who were alive, and someone too young to have been around in 1976, I think, really gets a flavor of that interesting year. And of course, by and large, your book focuses the most on Major League Baseball and this really, really important season in baseball history. At one point, you say the Lords of Baseball should have been celebrating since the game of baseball appeared as healthy as it had ever been, perhaps even healthier. In other words, there were ways in which Major League Baseball was, everything was just right. They
right.
Couldn't have asked for more. And yet there were, even at the very start of the year, already signs that this was going to be a tricky point of transition for Major League Baseball. Explain how both of those things were true in the moment.
You know, you're coming off the 1975 World Series, which to this day a lot of people believe is the greatest World Series ever played. That's the one with where the Reds and the Red Sox went seven games, and Carlton Fisk kept the Red Sox alive in Game 6 with a dramatic 11th inning home run, and it was the highest rated World Series broadcast ever, and the Major League attendance was at an all-time high. The game seemed in route good health, as it were. But the problem was really, what was on the horizon as far as the owners were concerned, which was the specter of free agency. Basically, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally, who were two pitchers who had pitched the 1975 season without a contract, the Players Association went to bat for them and said, like, okay, if these guys played a year without a contract, therefore they should be allowed to go to whatever, you know, to go to a new team, sign a deal with another franchise. And up to this point in time, that free agency didn't really exist. Catfish Hunter had been a free agent a year earlier thanks to a loophole in his contract. But for the most part, if you signed a deal with a team, you were with them until they didn't want you anymore. And if you wanted a raise, you had to accept, you know, you could ask for one, but if they didn't want to, your team didn't want to give you a raise, you just had to kind of lump it. So as part of an earlier collective bargaining agreement between the players and the owners, it had been decided that any sort of contract dispute, such as the one that Messersmith and McNally were having with their teams, would be decided by an arbitrator picked by the owners. And in this case, Peter Seitz, the arbitrator for these particular disputes, decided in favor of the players, which completely freaked the owners out, because it's like, wait a minute, this has never happened before, where players can sort of, you know, proclaim their own independence, which of course is interesting to me that the 200th anniversary celebration of American independence then coincides with this sort of, you know, independence revolution for the Major League Baseball players. So what then happens is by January, the Major League owners are already talking about locking the players out of spring training until they basically give up these new rights that they've won with via arbitration, and then that have been held up in federal court. And so it's a very tense time, because some of the owners, like Charlie Finley, clearly see what this is all going to mean. He starts trying to sell off his star players to other teams just to make some money before they all go. But other owners are perfectly willing to just sit out the 1976 season if it means breaking the players' union, which I'm not a fan of Bowie Kuhn, who was the commissioner of baseball in the 70s. But I think the one really good thing that he did was to step in during the spring training lockout in 1976 and say, you know what, we can't have. We can't have the bicentennial without the national pastime. This would be complete suicide for our sport, for our game, and just insisted that the players be allowed to come into spring training and the season start when it was supposed to, and that the conflict between the players' union and the owners would be settled off the diamond in conference rooms somewhere. And what eventually happens is that they come to an agreement where the players and the owners, where players play 6 years with a team, and then when they first come up, and then when that 6 years is done, or when their current contract is done, then they are free to put themselves on the free agent market if they like. And so in the end of 1976, we see the first full-scale, what they called the free agent reentry draft, which is much more complicated than it is today in terms of players signing with new teams. The deal back in 1976 was that players could be drafted by a certain amount of teams, all of which could then sort of vie with each other to sign the player. Now anybody can sign a free agent, but then they were still trying to figure out how all that would work.
I thought it was interesting when you said that this this agreement became known as the Basic Agreement, but you write, the final pact was so complex and convoluted it was almost comical to call it a basic agreement. and it helps us understand just why it was so hard to come to this agreement. But, of course, amongst all of the complexities of it, you write, the players would now have greater control of their own destinies than ever before. So this really marks a new beginning for the typical Major League Baseball player.
And I would also add that what we see in this first free agent draft is that the same owners who up till now just completely shuddered at the idea of giving their players a $10,000 or $20,000 raise per season are now throwing gobs of cash at the free agents. You know, just like they... And I forget who it was. It wasn't Bill Veeck. It was another owner who said or maybe it was Bill Veeck who said that really the best thing about the reserve clause was that it protected the owners from themselves and from each other. Hmm. Because you see that, like, as soon as, like, there are these star players, you know, guys like Reggie Jackson and Raleigh Fingers on the auction block, these owners just start going nuts and just, you know, backing up the proverbial in a truck full of cash to these guys' houses.
By the way, I don't think we've yet talked about something which became known as the Tuesday Night Massacre, which occurs a little earlier in the year, ahead of this basic agreement finally being hammered out. But it really is a great example of the sort of tumultuous atmosphere in the air. Explain to our listeners what the Tuesday Night Massacre was.
Well, we're talking about Charlie Finley, correct?
Yes.
Yes. So Charlie Finley was the owner of the Oakland A's, and the A's in the first half of the 70s were one of baseball's great teams. I still feel like they are the greatest team of the 1970s, even more so than the Big Red Machine. But Finley was also known to have a very hands-on and contentious relationship with his players, and definitely not one to give a raise easily, and in fact would often give his all-star players pay cuts because he legally could. So he sees the writing on the wall really more than anybody else does as the whole dickering over the reserve clause and is going on. He realizes that he has all these players who he hasn't signed, who are holding out for raises, and they're all going to walk at the end of the season, and he's not going to receive anything in return. There was no, at the time, there was no, you know, you would get some kind of draft pick as compensation, nothing like that. So he starts the season by trading Reggie Jackson and Kenny Holtzman to the Orioles for a bunch of players. And then the Tuesday Night Massacre happens in June when he decides that he's going to sell Raleigh Fingers, his top fireman, and Joe Rudy, his all-star left fielder, to the Boston Red Sox for $1 million apiece. And then he decides that he's going to sell Vida Blue, the team's star left-handed pitcher, to the Yankees for $1.5 million. Now, these are the sort of this is kind of unheard of. I mean, $1 million now doesn't seem that much in a baseball context, but at the time, that was a lot of money to sell a player for. No players had ever been sold to other teams for that kind of money, and it's this is a situation where Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner, steps in and is just completely horrified because he sees this turning into complete anarchy where owners are just selling players right and left. There's, you know, no continuity with the teams. And so he eventually steps in and nullifies all of these deals as, you know, being not in the best interest of baseball. So those players all have to stay with the A's at least till the end of the season. But in the case of Joe Rudy and Raleigh Fingers, they are sold to Boston while the Red Sox are in Oakland to play a series against the A's. So there are still a few pictures you can find out there on the internet of Fingers and Rudy, who never played a game for the Red Sox, wearing Red Sox uniforms and sitting in the dugout at Oakland Coliseum as Red Sox, and which they did for a couple of days until Bowie Kuhn said, you know, come on back to the A's and let's pretend this didn't happen.
Hmm. You write at one point, Finley's sales query set off a frenzied chain of events that would reverberate throughout the rest of the season and beyond. This is a season that is full of fascinating characters, including some great icons of baseball, including Hank Aaron at the very, very, very end of his illustrious career, and other giants like Johnny Bench and Reggie Jackson. In many respects, the most famous baseball player for at least much of this season is somebody who at a glance would never in a million years seem to be a professional athlete of any kind. I mean, he doesn't even look like he's maybe a badminton player, let alone a major league baseball player, a starting pitcher. Tell our listeners who maybe don't know anything about him, the phenomenon who was nicknamed the Bird.
The Bird, really, that's probably my favorite story of 1976, and in part because I was such a Bird fan as a kid that year. Because I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, just down the road from Detroit, so everything that was happening with the Tigers was kind of magnified in my world. But the Bird really transcended just Tiger fandom. He was a kid from Massachusetts who really, nowadays when a big prospect comes into the majors, there's a lot of attention on him. There was no attention on Mark Fidrich at all when he came up with the Tigers. No one really knew his story. No one really cared. The Tigers were terrible. And he was just kind of sitting on the bench for the first 6 weeks of the season, pitching an inning here, an inning there. And then he finally gets a start in the middle of May because another Tigers player is sick. So he fills in, pitches a two-hitter against the Indians, and people can't believe what they're seeing. He's this tall, gangly guy with like long, curly, kind of dirty blonde hair. Just looks like the kind of guy you'd see smoking pot in a car in a high school parking lot somewhere. But he's got complete mastery over these major league hitters, and then on top of it, he seems to be talking to the baseball between pitches, and he's running around out there with a little leaguer, like that same kind of joy that just exuberance that you don't see with major league ball players. But this guy's he's running over to his infielders after they make a great play and shaking their hand, and it's just like he's just so dynamic and fun to watch, and he's a really good pitcher. So word starts getting out that the Tigers have this weirdo who's on the mound who's really good. But this is 1976, where games are not widely televised, where you don't have SportsCenter, you don't have MLB Tonight, where you see the highlights of every game. So he was more kind of like a legend, people would talk about him, but unless you lived in Michigan, you probably hadn't seen him pitch or didn't know much more about him than what you saw in the box scores. But then at the end of June, he gets the start against the Yankees, who were the best team in the American League at the time, on Monday Night Baseball in Detroit, and he beats the Yankees quite easily, quite efficiently, and the national television audience gets to see him in action on the mound, dropping to the mound to manicure it to his personal specifications, and doing the talking to the ball thing and running around, and you just feel the electricity in the ballpark at Old Tiger Stadium that night. The place is completely full. People are going nuts for the Bird, and it just like strikes a chord with fans across the country, to the point where whenever the Tigers go to another town to play, they're good for a Bird start is good for an extra 10,000 to 20,000 people in the stands. And I think he was personally responsible for at least a quarter of the Tigers' attendance that season. And and by the end of the season, he was just—he's like this folk hero. He's not, and he's very. I guess the other thing that's very appealing about him is that he's very. He's very raw in a way. He's just like, he says what's on his mind, but not in an angry way, but just kind of like a goofy way, like you stick a microphone in front of him, and he might accidentally swear just because he's not, he's not really media savvy, and that was very appealing to people. And the other thing that was really another reason that the Fidrus story really struck a chord with a lot of people was because of what we were talking about with free agency and players holding out for more money. That really made a lot of fans angry at the time. They felt like there was, the player should be happy to play the game of baseball for a living and shouldn't be grousing about, making $80,000 instead of $100,000 or whatever. And here's this kid who obviously there's nothing in the world he'd rather be doing than playing baseball, and he's making rookie minimum, which is basically about $18,000 a year, and couldn't be happier about it. In fact, people, it was sort of the opposite. People felt that he should be making more money because he was obviously such an economic engine for the Tigers and baseball in general. So someone in Michigan actually started a send a buck to the bird campaign where people would just, put a dollar in an envelope, send it to Mark Fidrich, care of Tiger Stadium, just so he would have some beer money and know how much he was appreciated by the local fans.
One of the best photographs in the book is of the bird interacting with fans before a game at Yankee Stadium, and he is swarmed, and there's this look on his face of just utter delight. He looks like just a high school kid, and again, not anything like sort of the icy reserve of a well-coiffed professional athlete of today. I mean, it is
absolutely.
It's like he's from another planet.
That's one of my favorite baseball photos in general. I mean, he just looks so jazzed to be. I mean, he looks as jazzed to be talking to those kids as the kids look to be talking to him.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the essence of his appeal in a nutshell.
Right, and you don't see that anymore, very seldom. I want to finish out by saying that not only do you take us through this season, essentially week by week, and the ins and ups and the outs and ups and downs of the various teams, but you also tell us about a lot of what gave this particular season its wonderful flavor, including a lot of the innovative ways in which various owners were trying to jazz up greater interest and attract some attention and so on with all kinds of interesting spectacles and so on. And there are a lot of owners who have some really interesting ideas, like Ted Turner and others. I want you to tell our listeners about something which ended up being put together called Headlock and Wedlock Day at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium on July 11th. This was created by a baseball guy named Bob Hope, not the entertainer, but he was an entertaining guy, obviously, in this way. But tell our listeners about Headlock and Wedlock Day.
Well, Bob Hope was the director of publicity for the Braves, and he had worked for the Braves for many years. But when Ted Turner bought the team at the beginning of 1976, he immediately zeroed in on Hope, as Hope was going to be his guy to help really boost the profile of the Braves in Atlanta. I mean, the Braves were terrible; they had already gotten rid of Hank Aaron. There was really no reason to come to see the Braves, and Turner really felt that the Braves were going to be his anchor for his TV station, WTCG, which later became TBS. And so he really wanted to make Atlanta Fulton County Stadium a place where people could come and have fun, and despite the terrible team on the field, and that this fun would somehow be broadcast via his television station to the rest of the South and really sort of make Atlanta Fulton County Stadium a destination for people from far beyond Atlanta. And so via Bob Hope, he starts holding all these amazing promotional events and that go. I mean, he still has like Jacket Night and Bat Night and things like that, But then it goes far beyond that to, you know, he'll have ostrich races on the field before the game, or cash grabs where they come out on the field with a truck full of money and throw the money in the air and people scramble for it. But headlock and wedlock day was the result of two completely different special events being accidentally double booked. One was a Georgia Championship Wrestling exhibition, and another was a home plate wedding day, where couples would get married at home plate before the ball game. So they realized that they double booked the event, you know, very close to July 11th when it happened. But Georgia Championship Wrestling was one of Turner's big business partners, and so they didn't want to alienate them by rescheduling it. And then they also didn't want to disappoint the people who had already volunteered to get married at home plate. So they just decided to combine the two and call it headlock and wedlock. And that's what happened. Nine couples got married at home plate before the game. Then there's a game between the Braves and the Mets, and the Braves win. And then after that, they set up a wrestling ring in one of the picnic areas, and fans hang out and watch four bouts of Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Somehow that says a lot about the wild and wacky season of 1976 in Major League Baseball, that such things could occur and were allowed to occur and warmly embraced. And
absolutely.
It's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of all that you talk about in your terrific book. Again, it's called Stars and Strikes, Baseball and America in the Bicentennial Summer of 76. And we are taken all the way up to the conclusion of that year's World Series, which is relatively dull compared to the wild season which unfolds before it. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's, and the author, Dan Epstein. Dan Epstein, thank you for writing such a terrific book, and thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, thanks, Greg. I enjoyed it, too.
And since we have a little bit of time left in the hour, I want to read for you a portion of Dan Epstein's Stars and Strikes. This is the introduction, titled Play That Funky Music. Why 1976? For me, it all goes back to a friend's birthday party in April of that year. Tim's parents, a couple of free-thinking post-hippie types, piled a bunch of us fourth graders into their customized Dodge conversion van and took us all to see the Bad News Bears at Ann Arbor's Fox Village Theater. When we returned to their house, our minds suitably blown by the experience of seeing kids who looked and talked and, best of all, swore like us on the big screen, we each received wax packs of Topps baseball cards as party favors. The next day, my father patiently explained to me how to read the stats on the backs of the cards, and my transformation into a full-fledged baseball freak had officially begun. 1976 was the year I got my first baseball mitt, a cheap two-tone orange and burgundy Bud Harrelson model ordered from the Sears catalog. I attended my first major league game in 1976 and read my first issue of the Sporting News while grooving to the top 40 sounds emanating from my AM transistor radio. By sheer luck, it also happened to be the year in which Mark the Bird Fidrich became a bigger pop culture sensation than Dorothy Hamill, Bruce Jenner, and the Fonz put together. Padres left-hander Randy the Junkman Jones seemed, for a few months at least, on course for 30 victories, and Mets slugger Dave Kong Kingman pierced the ozone with tape-measure home runs, while new Braves owner Ted Turner and returning White Sox owner Bill Veeck lured fans to their ballparks with one bizarre promotion after another. Billy Martin led the New York Yankees to the postseason for the first time since Lyndon Johnson was president. Danny Ozark's Philadelphia Phillies and the Whitey Herzog-helmed Kansas City Royals emerged as exciting contenders. And Sparky Anderson's Big Red Machine rolled to its second straight world championship. In other words, it was a tremendously thrilling time to be a 10-year-old boy immersing himself in the myriad joys of the summer game. 1976, of course, was also the year of the Bicentennial, that nonstop nationwide party celebrating the United States of America's 200th birthday. But while we were all wrapping ourselves in red, white, and blue and saluting our founding fathers, our country was moving through a year of heavy political, social, and cultural transition. We were finally, or so we thought, putting the divisive era of Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War behind us, and searching for a renewed sense of optimism and connection in everything from CB Radio and Frampton Comes Alive to Olympic glory, Jimmy Carter's presidential run, and the movie Rocky. No longer at war anywhere in the world, and with the Cold War beginning to thaw, we focused our collective paranoia on things like busing, urban crime, swine flu, and Legionnaire's disease. Disco and punk rock, two of the decade's most important and divisive musical movements, were cooking in New York City and elsewhere, though they wouldn't reach full boil for another year. Hip-hop, which wouldn't explode until the early 80s, was already rocking hard amid the burned-out neighborhoods of the South Bronx. 1976 was also a crucial transitional year in baseball history, one in which the players finally won their war against the reserve clause, despite the best efforts of the owners and Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, thereby ushering in the free agency era and radically altering the game's economics forever. It was a year in which San Francisco nearly lost the Giants to Toronto, and the city of Seattle successfully sued the American League for a new franchise. It was a year that witnessed the reopening of Yankee Stadium and the final games of future Hall of Famer Hank Aaron, Frank Robinson, and Billy Williams. It was a year in which Oakland A's owner Charlie Finley, having almost single-handedly built one of the greatest dynasties in baseball history, proceeded to dismantle it like a stolen car in a chop shop. Yet 1976 is also a year that remains woefully underappreciated by baseball historians, primarily, or so I've long suspected, because its World Series was a one-sided affair that ended an exhilarating season on a dour and chilly note. While writing Big Hair and Plastic Grass, A Funky Ride Through Baseball in America in the Swinging 70s, I realized that the 1976 season was so rich with electrifying moments, oddball events, and unforgettable characters, all set against the star-spangled backdrop of the bicentennial, it truly needed and deserved a book of its own. After all, what other season can you name that featured a headlock and wedlock promotion, major league players wearing Bermuda shorts, and not one but two Harpo Marx lookalikes starting against each other in the All-Star game? Ah, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Why don't you just kick back on that red, white, and blue shag rug, pop in that 8-track of the first Boston album, pour yourself a glass of Matus Rosé, and get better acquainted with baseball in the bicentennial. I'll leave you two alone now. That's the wonderful introduction to Dan Epstein's terrific book, again titled Stars and Strikes, Baseball and America in the Bicentennial Summer of 76, published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's. I'm Gregory Berg.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes for The Morning Show from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Now, a minute before 9 o'clock, we will be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming at 9 o'clock. Between now and then, we can get you updated on the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. A decent day today, and then a pretty good weekend for us all in all. Today, partly sunny, breezy, and seasonal. A high today of 39. Overnight, partly cloudy and breezy, a low of 29. Saturday, sunny, windy, and mild, a high of 53. Sunday, partly cloudy, 40% chance of light rain, Sunday's high 55. Now, 26 degrees Racine, 27 Kenosha, 26 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.